Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together, whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.
This meeting is being recorded.
Hello and welcome to another episode of My Property World. We've got the fabulous Jay Howard and the wonderful Christine Chenoway back on. Great to have you on the show, guys.
Hi, thanks, Will. Thanks. Good to be
thanks
here
for having us.
Again. Thank you.
So Christine is a chartered surveyor. She's an absolute legend in the business. Unusually for a surveyor, she hasn't done one thing for her whole career. She's done a number of things, but she's done it in big ways and very different ways. Most of them have been around creating value, which is the subject of the show today. Jay Howard, another value diviner, he sees it where other people wouldn't even be aware of it. So the topic of today's show, and if you're wanting to get hold of Christine and Jay, I always forget to do this, so we'll do it now. Jay, how do people get hold of you at Hammett? What's the best way?
The best way is to email me, or if you somehow stole my number from somebody that you know, or you reach out to Will, a WhatsApp is the easiest way to get hold of me. But for email, it's jay@hammettauctions.co.uk. Yeah.
Fantastic. And Christine, always popular on social media.
Am I? Okay, I'll take that. You can find me on Facebook or LinkedIn, or you can, get my number off Will. That's the easiest way.
Okay, well, that's great stuff, guys. So we're going to come up with a number of ways to create value in property. So Christine, it's over to you first.
Okay. Well, my background's predominantly commercial leases, commercial asset management. So my with a commercial asset, my number one go-to sort of important item on a what shall I do with this asset list. So if you can hear the noise, I've got the builders in. Sorry about that. Is regear the leases. I would open negotiations with the commercial tenants to regear the leases. That could be changing the length of the lease, the rent review clauses, taking in or putting out a break clause, putting in or taking out a break clause, watering down onerous clauses to increase the rental value and all those types of things.
Okay, so renegotiate the lease. Give us an example where you've done this in the past and what was the... that point, what was the uplift?
Okay, so the best one I did is too complicated, so I won't go into that now. But a simpler one would be if there's an onerous clause in the lease. If you buy a commercial property, there's a tenant in there already on a lease. If there's an onerous clause, such as a very onerous yielding up clause, which is what they do at the end of their lease, water that down or give them a break clause. But in return for that, you want more rent. More rent, obviously, if you're looking for cash flow, is always a good thing.
And that is absolutely solid advice there, Christine. We're doing that on, we bought three industrial units in Bristol, myself, Piotr, and Ed Klein's. We bought it for 250 and some spare change, and it was producing £25,000 per annum. Since then, all three tenants have handed in their notice and they're planning on leaving. So they have to obviously stay for their notice period. But the one who's leaving earlier than all the others was paying about £8,000 per annum, and we're already getting that renegotiated to being £16,000 per annum. And then the other two will rent likewise. So we should end up with close to maybe £37,000-£38,000 bringing that in. So it's a solid way to just paperwork, essentially, just to massively...
Paperwork. Do you know, most asset management is paperwork.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to use your example, I talk about regearing existing leases. You can always encourage someone to leave so that you can grant a new lease to a different tenant, because your review clause may inhibit how much you can increase the rent under that current lease, which can be a bad thing.
Yeah.
Okay, over to you, Mr. Howard.
Well, I'm taking extreme license with what Christine has said, but I'm putting it into the residential context. I love a short lease flat, maisonette, or house. They are exceedingly expensive to mortgage, even if you can find the right kind of person to mortgage them. But the value margin between buying something with, say, a 36-year lease remaining on it, and then extending that lease to what you'll get at the end is massive. The extending residential leases is an absolute favorite of ours. And a really cool way to, if you're going to add value to an asset, the majority of these short leases are, you know, properties that still have avocado or salmon bath suites. You know, last time they were touched was in the 60s. And nothing wrong with that. But most people nowadays are looking for more contemporary, surrounds. So you could refurbish it, you could rent it, you could extend the lease. And what you end up with at the end is value at every step of the way. So, yeah.
I think a lot of people are quite unsure about short lease flats because, like you said, they're very difficult to mortgage. But if you've got cash available, then it's a really good way, to, as you say, to create a lot of asset value. Even if you simply serve the Section 42 notice, no, and then bung it in an auction. I'm sure you've done this, Jay. I can see from your face that you have. And flip it on before you, before you complete. You don't need to value what the cost of the extended lease will be. You serve the notice, you wait to get a reply from the freeholder. If they don't reply, well, what's in your notice? Like a fiver will do the job. Or if they do, you've got your parameters, haven't you? Your best and worst case scenario, flip it in an auction and away you go.
Yeah.
Okay. My one's even simpler again. Buy a vacant property and put a tenant in it. Ideally with a long lease or a high cash flowing. Initial rent. We could think of numerous examples. If you walk down your local high street, wherever you're living in the country, if there's been a vacant property at some point over the last number of years, as soon as someone puts tenant in, they sign a lease, the value increases. And it would be good to get a surveyor's 1 minute technical explanation how that works in terms of commercial yield valuation methodology.
I don't know anybody like that. Sorry. You're talking about a commercial property here, yeah. So you're looking for a tenant with a strong covenant, i.e. who's good for the rent and will be long-term good for the rent. Now, in the current market, it's very difficult to say who that was. I mean, when I started my career, M&S, would have been your number one anchor tenant if you were building a shopping centre, because they were absolutely rock solid. Are they still? I'm not casting any aspersions on M&S, but I suspect their covenant is not as good as it used to be. So finding a tenant with a really good covenant is the most important thing, because that's what drives value. When a commercial valuer is looking at a commercial investment valuation, sorry, I'm a bit croaky today. The property is incidental. They're valuing the income stream. That's what they're valuing. They're valuing how long it's going to last, how secure it is, how certain they can be that it's going to last for that length of time, how long the lease is, which gives you your stop, your end date. And then they're applying to that what's called an all risks yield. it's called an all-risk yield because it takes all other risks into account in one number, which is always quite a dangerous thing, I think. But it takes into account things like future rental growth, changes in the economy, interest rate, you name it. It's supposed to take all those things into account. So let's theorize about whether it does or not on another podcast. But basically, the yield is the inverse of the multiplier. So 8% yield, you multiply it by 12.5. To bring it down to its simplest terms, assuming that the income stream is long enough so that the end value, you know, is de minimis. Because once you get beyond 20 years, an income stream has little value anyway.
I'll go again. Change the tenant category. And quite often that you'll have a differential between what something's valued at as, and the most common example would be at the moment taking something from commercial to residential. And at different moments in time, it's more valuable to go back the other way. It doesn't appear that that's going to be the case in the next year or two, according to Goldman Sachs, which is picking a 15 to 20% fall in commercial real estate valuations on their institutional buildings, which is pretty harrowing stuff if you're a pension fund investor with one of their real estate funds. But that, of course, opens up opportunities for conversions to other uses, and the other categories can be either splitting up or combining spaces so they're more valuable with those different tenant types. There can be ways of formalising that through planning gains or physical changes to the
veering off your thing now.
Yeah, I would say you've just done two.
Veering into the, yeah.
You're being greedy with your strategies.
Isn't he just? He's just broadening it out to there'll be nothing else left by the time.
Save some for us mere mortals, please, Mr. Mallard.
I think it's quite interesting, isn't it?
With your next one,
we're going to talk to you now about this one. Hang on a tick. Oh, slow down. I think it's quite interesting how, just say, the retail market has changed even in the last 3 years. I mean, it was changing. It's been changing for a long time, but it had a fundamental change as soon as COVID hit, and it's not gone back. So we need to find other uses for all those buildings in town centres and bring town centres back to life. I mean, I know there's a lot of people doing a lot of theorising about that, and a few people are doing practical things to try and make it happen. But, you know, it's a problem. It's a difficult problem. And other uses may not always be appropriate or indeed valuable enough to warrant the change of use.
Well, I think that one of the things that make the commercial property conversion side of things tricky is the fact that there are a lot of mortgage companies that, just depending on what the commercial use is on the ground floor, you maybe got resi above and to the rear, they will either not lend, so give a nil value for mortgage purposes, or they'll discount by up to 25%. And in the modern day, the way that these buildings are, especially if you have those two separate individual things, the soundproofing and the fireproofing isn't what it was 20 years ago. So I kind of feel like they need to move their lending criteria along with the advent of better building materials and better, what's the word I'm looking for when they come and sign the stuff off? Building regs, that's it. With better building regs and things like that. Because I think it would make for a more viable living and investing solution if that was the case. But we could probably say the same thing for many parts of the, you know, for you guys, social housing is a bit of a real pickle to finance, you know, through the traditional means, right? So it's not the only one, but it's
you can understand why, like in all of the cases we've just been talking about, traditional mortgage monies come out of wholesale pools of money which are mandated to go specifically into residential only, with particular criteria about the type of properties, the portions of loan to values, and they're quite rightly not able to tweak with those because the wholesale money is ultimately coming from either a pension fund or a large institutional investor that is relying on that money to be there on the basis that it was put on. Now, anything that's slightly commercial and supported living is a really good example of this. And we've tapped into a little vein in a number of northern villages, basically, where we've identified these shops and uppers where you might have 3, 5, 6 flats above 1 or 2 or 3 retail shops. There's potential to convert 1 or 2 of the retail shops into an additional unit, and then use one of the shops as offices for the care provider within supported living. It also allows you to buy at a discount versus what the same property would cost around the corner in a block of terraced houses, because there's no commercial element with those. And by buying at a slight discount, it allows you to get into the deal at a lower point. You're creating an uplift on a commercial lease to an operator. They get what they want in that they've got an office with an interview room for their staff to, administer and provide some of the support and care on site. They've got 3, 4, 5 units that are within 10 yards of their front door, and it becomes very easy to manage, and all for a fraction of the price of the same thing would cost in a larger town or a city, even just down
just
the road.
Just in the north, though. That I don't think that's just in the north. I think every town in England you could do that. I think
the fact that you've identified a, like you say, a rich vein, you'll find those hot spotted throughout the country, absolutely.
And you have a look around the any of the real estate agents' windows, you go on Rightmove, there's no stock available at all to buy or to rent in so many of these little villages. Prices have gone crazy. In some places they've gone up by as much as 50%. Over the last 3 years. Now, you could argue that they hadn't gone up at all in the previous 15 prior to that, and you'd probably be right. But the supply isn't there. It's not economic to build new builds. Yeah.
Definitely applies more in the north. The build versus, resale value just doesn't work. Well, is somebody else allowed to have a go now again? Because you've had loads of time on yours.
Of course.
Well, mine was going to be get planning permission for another use, which sort of you started to veer into my lane there. But yeah, get planning permission. And of course, I'm sure most people know, but there will be a few people who don't know this. And it costs money to put in a planning application. But you can actually apply at the same time for several different things. You can get them all approved and then you can choose which one you do. Or better still, you can flip it onto someone else and let them choose. So sell off the most valuable planning permission is the way I think of it. See, mine's very short. Not like Mr.
Mallard. Could you give us an example?
Yeah, you veered into my lane. An example would be taking what was, say, like student halls or some sort of residential, a care home, and changing the use to supported living and putting it with an RP or the council, a registered provider or direct to the local authority. The reason that increases the value so much is because it alters the valuation yield significantly. Because of the strength of the covenant of the person who's going to be paying the rent or organisation, which is the registered provider or the council,
it's quite simple at that level. Like you're versus renting on AST to an individual where they
which
can give you a
very insecure, not long term, vanilla.
This is an organisation that might have a balance sheet that is comparable to a public company.
Absolutely.
You know, with hundreds of staff, lots of reputational risk, lots of systems, processes, and a likelihood that they're going to be around.
Indeed. That's why it's a really good idea. Jay, it's your turn, surely.
Yes, I believe it is. My next one could be controversial, but it's a statement.
We like controversial.
It's a statement to embrace land remediation, which is the removal of asbestos, the removal of Japanese knotweed, because that has, let's say you are making far too much money and the tax man is coming after you for hundreds of thousands of pounds, you can offset up to 150% of the cost of the removal of asbestos and the removal of Japanese knotweed. What it does is A, it reduces your tax that goes laterally backwards, or you can push it forwards, either way you like, is my understanding. But also what you're doing is you're making a property that was seemingly unmortgageable, now mortgageable by removing the hurdles, even with a care plan just for Japanese knotweed. You know, as a real estate margin trader, as I am, that is absolutely beautiful. It's 150% of the cost of it comes back to you almost as a benefit in kind. So, yeah, love that.
Oh, that's brilliant. So give us a quick example how the numbers would work on a specific deal.
So this one is rather pathetic, but it's also brilliant. We were selling a property for somebody in Walthamstow. Property previously under offer for about 600,000, and they found like half a square meter or something like that with that much Japanese knotweed. Obviously made it like unmortgageable. And they said, it was like, well, I'm moving to Portugal. I don't really care about this. I'm not going to get the care plan in place. I'm not going to do anything like that. The care plan, FYI, would have set the chap back by about £1,500. So in this instance, it was a tiny bit of Japanese knotweed with a tiny remedial like cost with a 10-year guarantee, all that kind of stuff. But I mean, so claiming back 150% of £1,500 isn't going to change anyone's lives massively, but it would have taken a property that sold for 465, £1,500 later, and you could very easily have back-to-back that into another auction, and it could have sold for 625, 650, whatever. So the benefit of solving the issue wasn't just 150%, it was the drastic increase in value once you solved a £1,500 problem. So yeah, that's a brilliant way to add value if you're ballsy enough.
Right,
yeah.
Fantastic. I'll go next. So marketing. So people often have a property and they haven't thought about how it might be marketed. And marketing in its simplest form is identifying who the best client might be, making them aware of the availability of the said product, or in this case, house, and making it easy for them to purchase it from you, and ideally quickly, and ideally in a way with certainty and maximising the price. Now, the very first house I ever listed as an agent, now 28 years ago, was back in New Zealand, and it was put into auction. And the very first day on the job, I was handed this listing, and the agent who I was replacing, who had left, had it for 5 years. So if you can imagine that you're sitting in the office and you've got to ring a vendor who's had this property on the market for 5 years and our agency hasn't sold it, and you ring them up and you find out another agent had it for 2 years beforehand, what's going through your mind at this point?
Never going to sell that damn thing in a million years.
I suggested that we'd put it in an auction, and I asked them for some money to advertise it, and we'd run some open houses. And we did exactly that. And it was in a bad part of town. It wasn't the greatest property in the world. And in the several weeks of marketing, only one person drove past it. So no one actually went inside. The day before the auction was scheduled, we were about to pull it from the auction, and we got a call from a representative of the tenant who was desperate to buy it before it went to auction the next day. So the tenant had been living there for 7 years, and never once had they thought of putting an offer in, and never once had anyone, including me, asked them if they'd like to buy it. But through the marketing that was created, the excitement that went into the auction and the pre-auction program, they were sparked into action and terrified that the house would be sold, and they'd be given notice and have to move on. And it worked out really well. So they got to purchase their first house. The vendor who needed the money out to move on with his life finally got his money, and I got my first sale. So it was win-win-win. I forgot about the bell. The bell's a great thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's usually a commercial agent's thing, ringing the bell. Oh, honestly. Boys' toys.
Okay, so one more from each of you to close it out.
Well, I mean, there's lots of little things you can do, aren't there? There's so many little things you can do. But so I just briefly mention, you claim capital allowances. If it's commercial property or you're doing a lot of work conversion, claim your capital allowances, because most people don't. They just think, oh, I don't really know what that is. It's too difficult. Put it on the really difficult pile, look at it later, and then later never comes. But as a commercial sort of specialist, if I can call myself that, what I would do with a commercial investment is I would just put some really good management in place, positive, proactive management. You can turn a lot of things around by doing that. Moving, say if you buy some few little, fairly dodgy industrial units on a sort of little industrial estate, you can make huge, huge differences by moving tenants around, maybe taking some buildings down, putting new buildings up. Marketing, as you say, if it's in a good location, putting some sort of site management in place, fixing the roads. I mean, reputation is a lot with these things. Just fixing the pothole. I mean, there's hundreds of things. And an example of this, because I know you're going to ask me for one, is many years ago, I know, but I acted for an institutional investor, big pension fund. They'd bought a really, really seriously dodgy industrial estate in Wales and gave it to me and said, what can you do with that? And I thought, my God, I'm not too sure. And it did take 18 months, and there was a lot of hard work. There was a lot of dilapidations, lease re-gears, kicking out tenants, getting new tenants in, security, site management, repairs, building onto vacant lots and putting good tenants in, all that type of thing. But the value, they paid just over £1 million for it, and 18 months later it was worth £12 million. So it is worth the effort, absolutely, even when things look completely hopeless. As long as you've got a plan and you know what you need to have at the end of that process. Well, it looks like this now, like a war zone, but actually in 2 years, 18 months time, 2 years, it's going to look, this is what we want to achieve. How do we get there? A to B. I worked for quite a long time as a management consultant, and management consultancy is actually the easiest thing in the world. Where are you now? A. Where do you want to be? B. What's the plan to get from A to B? That's basically it in a nutshell. And that's asset management as well, in a nutshell.
Fantastic. So the ABCs of creating value. Fantastic. I'm sure there's a course in that for someone listening.
Might be. Excuse me.
I would put underwriting. It's value creation at the point that the agreement is struck, because either you're able to secure it at a price that you're happy with, or you are able to profit from someone else being able to pay more from the asset than you are. It's one of those, you create the value at the point of purchase, and the underwrite really does kind of, pour that into concrete and set it. So it's so I would look at that. It's a high progressive strategy because if you're going into the underwrite, you have to be in a position and prepared to complete on that. It's not always going to sell for massive amounts above. But it does set your position strong. And more often than not, you're going to profit from that scenario. So.
We all need to listen to your podcast now to know all the ins and outs and the detail and the dirt on underwriting.
And I just have one final one to finish. So a planning application in an area filled with NIMBYs, so not in my backyard, people. The developer on putting the application in approached the Sexual Freedom Coalition and got them to run a party in the then vacant school that they had brought proceeded to put out 10,000 flyers in the immediate vicinity selling tickets to this party, which it sounds like was essentially a big orgy in this former school. And by the time the party had been said and done, and I believe that the developer made a little bit of money on their share of the profits from the party, there were no objections to the residential change of use that was being put through. So,
oh dear.
Yeah. So we might get the chap on at some stage. He's got some even more entertaining stories as well.
Yeah, and he's that's a marketing ploy as well, isn't it?
Indeed.
That's definitely a marketing ploy.
I know a developer who, like you said, had issues with the, too much noise, too much this, that and the other, not enough light or whatever rubbish they came up with at the time to not create an opportunity for people where to live in a house where housing is such short in supply. I'm sure the irony of their position isn't even noticed, even when you say it as blatantly as that. But he basically, he would go to a local, it wasn't a dump, it was like a refuse centre or something like that. And he would get him and six or seven labourers to fill up a flatbed and he would take it to the middle of his site and he would dump it all on there. And you'll be surprised how quickly the complaints came in about clearing it. And they said, look, we can keep going and clearing it because the council said to him, look, you know, the neighbours are getting upset, you should clear it. And I'll go and clear it. And when he went to clear it, it created the conversation, well, if you want this to stop happening, there needs to be something here. Otherwise, people are going to keep dumping on it. Can I rely on your support for a tasteful development where it's going to house people and blah? And that's how he did it. It just created the conversation rather than, rather than.
Please tell me he was able to put a 30-story tower on there.
Yes, yeah. There's 508 rooms going up there apparently, so
that's a very odd number to pluck out of the air.
I'm a genuine plucker, Christine, you'll be surprised.
I wouldn't be surprised though, that's the thing.
I think I may have killed Mr. Mallard. Yeah, I think breathe, Will, breathe.
Right, so you can get in touch with Jay Howard or Christine Janaway via LinkedIn or via myself. I'm Will Mallard. This is My Property World podcast. Great to have you on, guys. We'll have you back soon. Cheers.
Thanks, Will. Thanks, Jay.
Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together, whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.